he thinks we have them by the throat. And I think the Iranians think they have us by the throat.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center and a Bulwark contributor. And I'm joined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, professor emeritus of strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C., and a contributing writer to The Atlantic. Elliot, how are you?
Personally, I'm good, but politically, I'm feeling grumpy. So let's plunge right into jackassery, if we may.
Okay, please. Have at it.
So I'm an even-handed kind of guy. And after having spent most of the last year plus bashing the Trump administration and all its works, I want to say a few things about the Democrats, because this past week or two, there's really been a number of things which I think are pretty odious. One was people like Senators Tim Kaine and Mark Kelly voting against arms sales to Israel. And I just want to focus on Kelly for a moment, who was a naval aviator. And, you know, to vote against arms sales to a country which has been flying combat missions with our people. So Kelly was a naval aviator. Some of his contemporary counterparts have been flying missions with Israeli counterparts. And, you know, at the end of the day, no matter how much one loathes Trump and how much one loathes Netanyahu, they are our allies, and we're in a shooting war, and they're in a shooting war. And the reason why I find this odious is I don't think this has anything to do really with a considered view of Israel. I think this is cowardice and yielding to what's a general trend in the Democratic Party, which is to platform, I think you may have used the word sanewash, people whose antipathy to Israel goes so far that it does go over into anti-Semitism. So just a couple of the other examples. Graham Platner, supposed oysterman, who, however, went to Hotchkiss, which is a rather pricey private school, who had a Nazi tattoo, who's admired the October 7th attacks in a statement he subsequently scrubbed, who has gone on with a whole bunch of genuine, undoubted anti-Semitic podcasters. This is somebody who may very well be the Democratic nominee for the Senate in Maine, and it doesn't matter to those people. Or I think the most odious thing has been the platforming of Hassan Piker, who, again, genuinely an anti-Semite. I mean, this is a guy who says Hamas and Israel, same thing, but it's actually stuff that's a lot worse than that. I believe he said we deserved 9/11. And you have all kinds of people making excuses for these folks. And I think I know you have something to say about it, but I think that the broader picture is of a Democratic Party that is willing to cave to its extreme left wing, or it's not even left, isn't even the right word for it. It's extreme progress. I don't even view these people as progressive. It's extreme wing, let's call it, which is no different and no better than the Tucker Carlsons and the Candace Owens. And it's opportunistic, it's cowardly, and I think it's going to blow back and bite them. Because if you're looking at the Senate, for example, I think if they do succeed in nominating Abdul El Sayed, who's been palling around with Hassan Piker, they guarantee that Mike Rogers, who's basically a normal Republican of the kind that you and I could deal with, will win. And a good thing, too. And so maybe they'll have to take a couple of shellackings before they realize that cowardice actually does not beat principle when you have something to say. So those are my thoughts.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, I think, you know, it's up to both sides of the political aisle to, you know, police their own extremists. And the failure of Republicans to do that, has brought us the Republican Party that we have today. And when you read Ben Rhodes in the New York Times, essentially, and I did use the term sane washing Graham Platner, It's in service of a kind of left-wing version of the isolationism, you know, the ritual incantation against endless wars that you see on the Republican, alt-right, far-right, neo-Nazi, Nazi-adjacent forces that Republicans have allowed to, run wild. I mean, this is, I think, bad politically for Democrats, but moreover, I think it's bad for the nation. And it's in the same way, it's really horseshoe theory. It is the exact parallel to what happened to the Republican Party. And if they hadn't had that example staring them in the face, one might say, well, they're trying to manage a political coalition. Those are hard. But we know what happens when you don't, pay attention to this. So I'm with you 100%.
Yeah. I would just add that, cowardice is really the first cousin of jackassery. And I think when you begin to cower in front of people on the extremes, you end up doing stupid things that hopefully you will regret later on. And conversely, when you take principled stands, okay, sometimes you will go down, and there were certainly Republicans who went down for taking principled stands against Trump. But, then again, we just have the example of Tom Tillis, who said, look, I'm not going to approve Trump's pick for the Federal Reserve until they drop this insane prosecution of the current chairman of the Federal Reserve, and they backed down.
Right.
And, I just there's a part of me which just wonders, I wonder what Teddy Roosevelt would say if he was looking at both parties. And I think, seething contempt is probably the best way to capture it. Anyway, now that I've gotten that off my chest.
Yeah, no, I quite agree, including with your characterization of TR's likely response. My jackassery of the week is 29-year-old Deputy Assistant Secretary of Homeland Security for Counterterrorism. An issue that probably ought to be taken seriously in light of the, current circumstances. But Julia Varvaro, the 29-year-old who was occupying that position, had to be suspended by the powers that be in the leaderless DHS because she was both accused by a former boyfriend of having milked him for $40,000, but also having been present on sugar daddy websites. Who knew? Websites where young women can look for older companionship that is meant to keep them in the style to which they would like to be accustomed and maintain their lifestyles. Only the best people in the Trump administration, and it's
well. I remember our old friend and mentor Al Bernstein always used to say, first-rate people hire first-rate people. Second-rate people hire third-rate people. Third-rate people hire total losers. I mean, that's my take on the Trump administration.
Well, let's turn our attention, if we can, to someone who is a multiple winner of the jackassery of the week, which is the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, who's been in the news a lot, including a press briefing that he gave this morning. Why don't you talk about your reaction to the press briefing, and then we can dig into some of his other activities during the course of the week.
Yeah, we are going to have to retire his number when he finally leaves. I mean, he belongs in the Jackassery Hall of Fame. I didn't listen to the press conference, but I read the transcript, which the so-called Department of War, actually the Department of Defense, sends out. And I will tell you the thing that struck me about it. I mean, set aside all the usual totally classless, cheap sneers at previous administrations and the completely shameless toadying and brown nosing towards Trump. Those are all there, and we expect that from Hegseth. But what was striking about it was the way he described the war and the blockade was the tone of somebody who A, thinks they are completely winning, and that, you know, the objective which will be achieved is total victory and total confidence. We've got all the resources, and we are just going to squeeze the life out of these people. And it did not sound at all like somebody who's been told by the president to prepare for some sort of compromise, some sort of way out. I have to say, and we're going to have a longer talk about the war. I think people have been may have been mistaken when they've gone for some sort of version of the taco bet that Trump always chickens out, sort of assuming that he'll eventually back down. I mean, there was one thought that occurred to me, which was, I wouldn't say sympathetic to Hegseth, but, you know, when a war breaks out, people immediately resort to a very limited number of words to explain what's going on. One, of course, is quagmire. I mean, that used to be the particular province of Johnny Apple at the New York Times, that whenever war happened, this is Vietnam all over again, we're in a quagmire. Another word that gets overused a lot is stranglehold, that Iran has a stranglehold on the world. And, you know, that invariably comes with a picture of, there's some sort of gigantic poster in Iran showing an Iranian hand on the Straits of Hormuz. The truth is, we have a stranglehold on Iran as well. And at least Hegseth is insisting that we're getting every single major ship that comes out there. Maybe not, you know, little speedboats or something like that. So actually, the truth is, the United States does sort of have a stranglehold on Iranian commerce. And it is true, the Iranians have a stranglehold on global oil exports coming out of the Persian Gulf. So I note all that, and it does make me think that there's a good chance that this could go on for quite some time. I know you said you hadn't read the whole thing or watched the whole thing, but you probably had some sense of some of the highlights.
Yeah, I did see some of the outtakes from it on Twitter. It struck me as a typical Hegsethian, you know, performance in the way that you described. We could come back to some of the details about the blockade and blockades in general and how this is working in a second. But the problem, you know, I think of the Hegseth press conferences is his presentations stand in pretty stark contrast to his wingmate, you know, General Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who almost always uses his time to give a kind of Joe Friday, just the facts, ma'am, you know, briefing on the actual state of the war. They're not quite as informative as some of his predecessors. You know, they tend to be much more focused on the kind of inputs rather than the outcomes, which I think has been a tendency, not just of his, but of CENTCOM's briefings as well. And the rest of the time is spent actually lauding the men and women of the U.S. Armed Forces for what they're doing. And the contrast, I think, I could be reading too much into this, but I do believe it's kind of intentional on the part of the uniformed military, because I think most of the senior leaders understand that Hegseth is a profoundly unserious person and, you know, should not be in charge of running a war, you know, much less the largest bureaucracy in the federal government. I mean, he's been busy on other fronts. So, you know, one of the things he seems to do well at is, you know, firing people. I mean that in the archest sense, person, you know, possible. I mean, so this week, you know, after previously relieving the chief of staff of the army, he now relieved the secretary of the Navy, John Phelan. And as best I can tell, and I'd be interested in what you have managed to decode about this, this appears to be largely a kind of interpersonal conflict between Phelan and Hegseth and his deputy, Stephen Feinberg, the deputy secretary of defense. over who gets to control the kind of buildup of naval forces that President Trump has said he supports, and which I think most people believe is necessary. But the way they got him fired was to go to Trump and basically complain that Fillon was not going to be able to deliver the Trump-class battleship by 2028, which nobody can do. I mean, just because of, you know, the limitations of our, you know, shipbuilding industrial base, and particularly given the high-tech components to designing this thing. I mean, you don't design, you know, a battleship. You'll know better than I the exact timelines for the Iowa-class in World War II, but that was with a nation fully mobilized, for material production and, you know, designing much less technically complicated vessels. So, I mean,
And one can go beyond that. You had a mature design that, you know, was well understood. And even then, it took like about 3 years to build battleships. And this is, I think the Trump-class vessels were supposed to have about a 30,000-ton displacement. That's comparable, actually, to Iowa-class battleships. So I guess the things that I've picked up is that a lot of this had to do with tension, actually, with Feinberg, who did not think that Phelan was up to overseeing construction programs. So they had already taken submarine construction, which is, of course, a very technical business, away from Phelan, and had appointed somebody else who's in charge of it, reporting directly to the deputy secretary. That's a very bad sign. I mean, if you really can't trust the Navy secretary to do it, you should have fired him before. I think they had to tread carefully because Phelan is an old friend of Trump's. He's a neighbor of his at Mar-a-Lago. And, you know, he's been a successful suck up on the Trump class battleships. The impression you get is that Feinberg is actually more interested in pushing subsurface warfare and in general unmanned systems and stuff like that. So it may also be that they don't particularly care for this this notion. And you know, it's actually hard to believe that we'll build this class of ships. I mean, it's hard enough to build modern destroyers, ships like this with all kinds of fancy technology, not really. There's that. There's personality clashes. It was interesting that he apparently went to the White House. They didn't give him a heads up. I mean, when these people do something like this, they are so graceless. There was no heads up. So there he is. He's going around giving talks at, I forget what, public gathering.
Yeah, he was on the hill, actually. He was on the hill.
Yeah. He doesn't, you know, he's stunned. So he then makes an appointment to see Trump. Trump keeps him waiting for an hour and confirms it. I suspect that Hegseth and Feinberg may come to regret this somewhat because Trump finds it very hard to break with his old financial friends and neighbors. And I'm sure that Phelan must be furious. And I am sure that he will continue to interact with Trump and he will be spilling poison into his ear. And I would also suspect that, you know, he's another one of these finance guys with a big ego. He'll be spilling poison to a lot of journalists as well. So I think, you know, anytime something like this happens, all the journalists I know lick their chops because it means you've got somebody else who wants to settle some scores. The larger issue, of course, is that actually naval construction has been a disaster for some time. The Navy, and by the way, I don't think one should let the uniforms off the hook either. I mean, we can just in this conflict, you can see two monumental problems. One, the absence of mine hunting now rather than mine sweeping. That's a somewhat archaic term. Vessels and the absence of frigates, and the Navy's. I think we discussed this last time that they've tried several things, and now they're setting on some kind of cockamamie, upgraded U.S. Coast Guard cutter, which doesn't even have vertical launch tubes for the various kinds of missiles that it has to carry. But, you know, I think these people being what they are, nobody's really going to sort of take stock of this and figure out what happened and fix it. There's also, I think there was some indication that Phelan was not as keen on going on witch hunts for wokesters, for woke admirals. And that was some of the tension with Hegseth. So in other words, akin to the tension between Dan Driscoll, the Secretary of the Army in Hegseth. The only thing is, I think Driscoll is politically smarter, and he already kind of got out there and said, no, I'm staying, even as he's defending Randy George. But, it's another sign of what Hegseth is like as a manager. Let me ask you a question. Do you think this ends up doing long-term damage to the senior officer corps?
Well, to pick up on the conversation we had last week about General George's removal, this is just another signal of, the paranoia, the kind of mean-spiritedness of Hegseth as a manager. And, I do think it sends very bad signals to the senior officer corps about what it takes to be successful in the Pentagon under this regime. And the problem is, the longer this goes and the more it looks like it's a quasi-permanent, by bureaucratic standards, dispensation, the more damage it'll do. And so I do worry about institutional damage, and not just to the senior uniforms, but also to, senior civilians. I mean, we now have a acting Secretary of the Navy, who was a failed Senate candidate in Virginia and a failed congressional candidate in Virginia, who apparently believes that, California is being taken over by witches.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, I hadn't.
Yeah. No. So this is in a podcast that he did, a while ago.
California's been taken over by witches. Exactly. So, I would like to, I'm going to hereby apologize to the Iranian member of parliament that I was making fun of earlier today, who said that the reason why the new supreme leader, Mojtaba Khamenei, has not appeared is that because of the high development of occult sciences in Tel Aviv, and that, they would be casting spells and stuff like that. And I think I sent you the link to that. I sent it to some other friends and, what idiots, but who knew, let us not cast stones. Those of us who live in glass houses, that's all I can say.
Let's return to that because it's a, point you made to me in the green room about kind of where we are in this war in terms of how the two sides see each other. But before we do that, one other element of Hegseth's jackassery at the Pentagon this week that goes back to something we talked about last week, which is apparently there is a naughty and nice list of European allies in NATO that the Pentagon is keeping, and it's looking, for ways to punish members of, the alliance who have, been, less tractable and not cooperative with the administration in the prosecution of this war. A war that we ought to note, was started by the administration without any consultation of the allies or even forewarning. But in particular, they're looking at the possibility of suspending Spain from NATO. Believe me, people have looked at the possibility of doing this in the past to France or Turkey or other countries. I'm pretty sure that you can't do it. But also they want to revisit, for instance, whether the United States should recognize the British claim on the Falklands, because let's resurrect that 40-year-old conflict.
Yeah. The British thing is ridiculous. I have two thoughts. One is, I'm rather more sympathetic on Spain because Pedro Sanchez is poisonous and he is really going out of his way to be hostile to the United States. And I think, I do think what people don't realize is the United States often lets countries get away with doing that kind of thing. And, I think one of the virtues of John Bolton, who you and I have talked to on this podcast before, is John believes, and I think he's right to do so, that, you know, you reward your friends, and when people are really hostile to them, you tell them that there's a price to be paid. But and this leads to my second point, it's interesting that the Pentagon is thinking about this on their own. Well, they can't kick Spain out of NATO. That's ludicrous. But this might be the kind of thing where in a normal administration, you might have some meetings in the Situation Room where you say, look, there's an argument to be made that you want people to understand that if you know, it's one thing if you say, I'm not in this war, I opt out. It's another thing if you really go out of your way to try to obstruct us or make our lives difficult or denounce us.
With overflight and things like that.
Yeah. Why don't we think of some way to let everybody know that there's a cost for crossing us? And it might be that Commerce would come up with something, or Treasury would come up with something, or State would come up with something. That I would have no objection to. But the very fact that it's the wizards of the Pentagon who are trying to come up with this just tells you there is no process, and ultimately there is no policy. There's peak, but peak isn't the same thing as policy.
Yeah. I mean, this goes back to the conversation we had last week in the sense that, you know, what constitutes effective alliance management? And, you know, certainly there have been some positives from that have come out of the Trump, hostility to NATO, including getting people to take defense budgets more seriously than they have. Although that was even underway, frankly, before, Trump came into office the first time, the process was beginning. But I'm concerned that, you know, really there's more damage going on here than the value that we're getting out of this approach. I would point to this week, the statement by Donald Tusk, the prime minister of Poland. Poland is one of the most pro-American countries in NATO. But, you know, Tusk was basically saying, you know, we can't be totally dependent on the Americans because we can't totally rely on them. I just saw a blog post by Mina Olander, who is a Finn, a very smart young woman who was a defense analyst there. And her point was the Nordics are very exposed right now to Russian pressure, particularly Finland, which has a, you know, long, you know, 800 mile border with Russia. And she was talking about Nordic defense cooperation and how seriously the Nordics are taking it because of the threats that the U.S. has made against Denmark. And that, I think, you know, that I'm afraid is going to be lasting. I'm not saying that there's no way a, you know, future administration can't, you know, help repair some of that damage. But I think it's going to stick for a while.
Yeah, I think the damage will stick. I saw the same. I think it's a Substack.
Yeah, Substack.
And I know Mina, and she is a very, very smart and thoughtful person.
And not anti-American at all.
No, far from it. And I guess on the one hand, I completely understand it and sympathize with it. And, you know, you and I have pounded our fists on the table about the criminal folly of threatening to take Greenland by force and all that. I do think some of our European friends, and I think also some of the Canadians too, are just kind of wallowing in, we can never trust you again. And I find it's a bit excessive. I mean, this is a serious crisis. Trump is a serious danger. It's really a pretty elementary error, I think, to conflate Donald Trump and the United States of America. Now, you can say, well, you guys elected him, and that's perfectly true. But let's face it, just about every modern democracy has had disruptive right-wing movements, populist movements, and will continue to do so. But in any case, it's just not realistic. I mean, whoever comes after Trump will be different and will probably, let's say it's somebody like Rubio, maybe not Vance, but I don't think Vance has much of a chance anyway. If it's somebody like Rubio, I think you'll have much more reversion to the mean. So I think, and I also think that some sobriety about the commonality of interests and yes, values is really in order. And, you know, it's easy for them to feel self-righteous and imposed upon. And because they know, among other things, you know, you can really milk that when you're dealing with an American audience of people like us or, you know, kind of normie foreign policy types. And we'll go, you're right. We feel so badly. But it's self-indulgent is really what it is. And I think, by the way, this is true for the Canadians. So, you know, Mark Carney said, we're going to detach ourselves from the United States. Well, good luck with that, pal. I mean, when you have a couple thousand mile border, the economies are tightly integrated. They're going to continue to be tightly integrated. Yes, you can do more deals with China. By the way, a country that if you're investing in AI there, they might not let your staff leave the country, not just your money, let alone stealing your intellectual property. I mean, get real, is, you know, my views. So though I, you know, I fully understand and I sympathize and agree with the fear and loathing generated by Trump, I also think this is going a bit too far. And I think it's a good idea for people like us to kind of point that out to some of our European friends.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a good case in point, George Robertson had an op-ed in the Telegraph, which, you know, made many of these sort of European points about trusting the United States. And while I read it and found myself, you know, in sympathy with Lord Robertson, who is an excellent, you know, NATO Secretary General, was a pretty good Minister of Defense in the UK. You know, I thought he carried it a little far because, as you say, I mean, at the end of the day, the logic of the transatlantic link for both sides is really pretty compelling. And so I think, you know, look, I think Europeans would be well advised to, you know, continue to build up their own defense, you know, capabilities. We need that. We in the United States need that. And they need it for themselves. But avoid any permanent steps that, you know, damage the institutions of NATO and the transatlantic alliance, because I think those institutions need to be maintained so that when we get beyond Trump, we can actually go back to the business of actually trying to manage alliance tensions and whatnot. I will say one thing about, you know, punishing, you know, allies who transgress. You know, probably no ally in the history of the alliance, you know, has been more in that role than the French, right? Starting with, not even starting with de Gaulle, but certainly under de Gaulle and subsequently. And having at one point, you know, in the Bush administration looked at, you know, what are the things we can do to punish France? And, you know, going back and looking at the historical record, we never did very much to, quote, punish, you know, France. And, you know, in the end of the day, France has remained an important part of the alliance. They are going to continue to be an important part of the alliance. And while it's easy to get swept up in the moment, you know, emotions get very high, I think recognizing that, you know, some of this is just the inevitable tugging and hauling of an alliance that's now 32 nations. And one, you know, there's never been, I think, an alliance that's this broad that survived so much, so many contretemps and still functions extremely well. And I think it's important not to get vertigo when you're trying to deal with all this.
I agree, but I think the difference between the French and the Spanish is first, when there's a real crunch, the French come through. You know, as de Gaulle did during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Even in the worst days, as you and I both remember, say, of the Iraq War, French intelligence cooperation with us remained very good. Military cooperation with us remained very good. We aligned on a lot of things, including, above all, the Iranian threat, where they were frequently tougher than we were. They were always actually quite responsible about their own defense. Spain is one of the arch freeloaders of the NATO alliance. You know, they radically underspend. And Pedro Sanchez really went out of his way not to say just we think this is a bad, you know, this one thing's a bad idea, but to really say, no, we need to kind of break away from the United States and so on and so forth. So it's not as serious. It's France, you know, has French statecraft is what it is. And it, but it's serious, at least. You know, I've always felt that way. You've always felt that way. This is actually this is Spanish domestic politics. One of the things that was not reported, by the way, in American papers, but was reported in Spanish papers because I was there. This is all happening while Sanchez's wife is being indicted right. for corruption.
Right.
And so
right.
a lot of this is what he's doing is playing on anti-American sentiments in order to get out of a domestic
sure.
political pickle.
Which is,
and that makes it more reprehensible.
Yeah. I mean, in that sense, it reminds me quite a bit of Gerhard Schroeder in,
yes.
you know, in 2002, who's turned out to be quite, you know, a bad actor.
Essentially, I mean, a Russian shill.
A Russian shill. So, yeah. Well, let's go on to the war and kind of where we stand. I mean, you made a really interesting point in the green room about the mutual incomprehension of the leadership on both sides. And we may be running into that even as we speak, because according to the White House, Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff are en route, you know, to Islamabad to meet. They are not sending Vice President Vance with them because Speaker Golubov is not going to be going to Islamabad. And there's a question about whether Golubov is going to continue to be the head of the Iranian delegation. There's all sorts of rumors on the internet about him being replaced by Saeed Jalili, the former nuclear negotiator and National Security Council head between 2007 and 2013. You and I remember his tenure, at least the first year and a half of it, pretty well. Not a good augury were that to happen for the prospect of negotiations. I just leave it at that. So what's your take on all of this about?
You know, one of my we all have some all-purpose quotes that we always use. One of mine is from the great historian John Lukács, who said who thought, by the way, that Hitler was very smart. But he said, you know, Churchill was a better strategist than Hitler because Churchill could sort of imagine what it was like to be Hitler, but Hitler could never imagine what it was like to be Churchill. And I think here we're dealing with a case where the senior leadership on both sides is incapable of understanding the other. I mean, I don't think the Iranians know how to read Trump at all, or even their own circumstances. I really think they think they're winning. Trump, I don't think, you know, can get inside the head of the IRGC, General Vahidi, or any of the other characters, and it's a very complex array of characters, as we've discussed. So there's this profound mutual incomprehension, I think. I suspect that both sides really think that they have the upper hand. I mean, that's, you know, to go back to the Hegseth press conference, that's what you get. The sense you get from that press conference is there's no question in Hegseth's mind, and I don't think he's smart enough to fake it, but that he thinks we have them by the throat. And I think the Iranians think they have us by the throat. And in circumstances like that, it's kind of hard to see what sort of negotiation you're going to have. On top of which, and this may actually be a case where Trump is speaking the truth, I think it is the case that their leadership is fragmented. If Mojtaba Khamenei has not appeared in public, it has to be because there's something wrong. I mean, I doubt that it may be because he's afraid of the witches in Tel Aviv casting spells on him if he does. But I think he must be pretty badly beaten up or, you know, have half his face blown off or something like that. It's clear there are different factions in the IRGC. And to go further back, I mean, Khamenei built this rather elaborate structure with lots of different players. And, you know, he was, I think, pretty, the sense you get is he was pretty masterfully kind of moving the pieces around on the chessboard. And what the war has done is it's kind of tossed that chessboard up in the air. Now, some of the pieces have been knocked off the board completely. Some of them have been put back on the board, but nobody knows what the original positions were. So I think there's incoherence. And then you have incoherent decision-making on our side because it's all, you know, what occurs to Trump at 2 a.m. while he's posting on Truth Social. So I don't think any of this augurs well. And I can imagine a number of scenarios. I can imagine a return to kinetic activity. I can also imagine a prolonged standoff. Or I can imagine Trump just wanting to get done with this and move on to something else and cutting a deal. I don't know. What do you think's likely?
Yeah, I see it similarly, although I think maybe a couple of nuances here. So to me, the Iranian leadership seems very much like the Soviet leadership in the immediate aftermath of Stalin's death. You have a situation where you had a supreme leader, Stalin, the Vojd, who made all the decisions, ultimately playing off, factions against, one another, as he did very masterfully. And I think that's what Khamenei did as supreme leader. You now have his son, who was clearly the choice of the IRGC, who lacks his auctoritas to say the least, and maybe dead. I mean, the Israelis, many of them think he's dead. You had this, Farnaz Fasahi story in the New York Times about he's had three operations on his leg, all this very interesting detail she's gotten from, regime insiders. Three operations on his leg, badly burned lips and face, which makes it very hard for him to talk. And therefore, he doesn't want to, appear in public. Who knows? But what I do think you have on the Iranian side, as you did on the Soviet side after Stalin died, is a kind of collective leadership, which has to arrive at a consensus. And they're at sixes and sevens. So Golubov has been under pressure for days, including for his, videos that emerged of his wife and daughter taking a tourist swing through Turkey while, the rest of Iranian society is, living under the threat of bombardment. I think you're right that both sides think they're winning and that time is on their side. And honestly, I'm not sure who's right about that in the following sense. I mean, this is a competition at some level and who can absorb the most economic pain. The administration thinks, perhaps correctly, I don't know, that they're very close to getting the Iranians to the point where they're going to have to cry uncle because they're going to run out of oil storage. They're going to have to cap wells. They're going to have trouble getting food into the country because of the blockade. They already were suffering from a food distribution problem. This is going to exacerbate it. They're not going to be able to earn foreign exchange, and therefore the currency, which, whose collapse was what caused the big demonstrations in December and January, is going to get driven down further. And there's a whole, you can construct a narrative that says, yes, that's right, they're going to have to say uncle. Except that's been the narrative from the beginning of this war, that just, hit them harder and they're going to fold. And this is a very ideological bunch that doesn't give a shit about the condition of its public, and I'm not convinced they're going to fold. I'd add one other thing to that, which is blockades are always leaky. You know, it's great to say we've got an airtight blockade. It's hermetically sealed. They're not getting anything in or out. But you and I know that that's not how these things work. And it's already clear that, you know, some large number of vessels got through. I mean, that's, you know, from data that comes from the, you know, maritime authorities who track all this. And, you know, will the American, you know, will the U.S. Navy catch up to some of them in the Indo-Pacific? Maybe, but maybe not. You know, if they hug the coastline inside the territorial waters of not just Iran, but Pakistan and India, they can go a long way and get to port. So the Iranians have ways of stringing out that timeline that the administration is operating on, which, by the way, I think is roughly the timeline that Trump always favors for everything, 2 weeks. you know, I think they can drag this out for a little bit longer. Meanwhile, the president gives every indication from the number of times he's extended the ceasefire, despite the blood-curdling rhetoric in his Truth Social posts about, I'm going to end a civilization, 48 hours, open the strait, you crazy fuckers, you know, all of that. He's shown a great hesitance to go back to kinetic force, you know, and why is that? I think it's because, number one, he knows this war is extremely unpopular. I mean, not only did he not do anything to prepare the public for this, but he hasn't done a very effective job of communicating during the 8 weeks. And if you look at the polling, the war started out with historically low support. It's now somewhere like 2/3 of the public, you know, hates this and attributes high prices at the gasoline pump, not totally inappropriately, you know, to him and to this war. He also knows if he goes back to kinetic activity, he knows that he's shrewd enough, I think, to understand that the market has been, you know, perhaps systematically underpricing the risk here, in part because of the assumption that he's going to taco. And if he goes back to kinetic activity, there's going to be a market reaction, and it could be quite severe. Because it's not just oil, right? If it's not just oil, it's also helium and sulfur and, you know, urea and ammonia. It's food, you know, potentially because of the fertilizer that's at planting time in a lot of the world that is going to be affected here. So it's not clear to me at all, you know, who can take the most pain here. And I guess, you know, we'll find out.
So I mean, I agree with the basic judgment. I'll just add, you know, a couple little twists, which may modify it a bit. I think on the Trump side, you know, we have to remember we're dealing with somebody who's both ignorant and callous. And so, for example, I think he genuinely does not understand that oil is fungible. His view is, we've got lots of oil and other hydrocarbons, and our exports actually have been shooting up. That's true. I mean, probably there's a limit to how much you can even sustain that. But so, you know, he doesn't, that global shortage, he doesn't care. I mean, that's at a certain level. Maybe he should care, but I don't think he does.
He cares about the price effect, though.
He cares about that, but I'm not sure he even understands the price effect. Because we have lots of oil. So what, you know, he is in some ways smart, and in other ways he's incredibly dumb. And I think that may be one of the ways that he's incredibly dumb. And I don't think there's anybody there who's really going to argue him out of it. He's also, I think he understands this war is actually going to be the dominant event of his second term. If he didn't know that already, he probably knows that now. And he has committed so much of his prestige and ego and all that. And he is never going to run again, as he knows perfectly well, that he could go back to kinetic action. And the truth is, as you were saying, you know, we are continuing to move stuff there. There are now three carriers there. We're moving more Marines. So he, and now that's partly to maintain pressure and to keep options on the table. But it's not only that I don't buy taco. I think it's You know, maybe there's Tesco. I mean, he sometimes chickens out, but sometimes he doesn't chicken out. And I've given up trying to predict him. On the Iranian side, I would just say that I think we have to remember first that there's a lot of variation in the IRGC leadership. I think Kalibaf is one kind of character. Vahidi is another. I think they do have to care about the economics because they care about the regime. And, you know, once people are really desperate, they may, not only might they try something again, but you may have people inside the system who are willing to try something. And I also believe at the end of the day, look, they're Iranian patriots in that they don't want their country to fail. Now, somebody like Vahidi, from everything I read about him, is, you know, he's just a hardcore fanatic who is equally ignorant, but in a different way, and more callous than Trump. So he may not care. But other people, you know, and by all accounts, Kalibaf is a smart guy. People like him may care. But they're also, at the very last thing I'd say is, at the same time, you know, the advantage Trump has is he doesn't have to play an internal game to maintain his power. He's the president, and everybody's just going to give a sickly grin and follow him. Whereas these guys, you know, I am sure that most of their energy is consumed with watching each other. I think that the one recommendation that we should absolutely give to all of our viewers is, if you haven't seen Death of Stalin, you should watch that movie.
I agree.
You see that, like, even at the funeral, they're all, you know, trying to shift position and angle each other out of it. And they are very, the other good thing about that movie is they're very different characters. You know, Beria is one kind of character. Khrushchev is another character. Malenkov, you know, Zhukov.
Molotov.
Yeah, they're not,
it's a great movie.
All the same. Yeah, oh, it's a fantastic movie.
Look, I largely agree with that. And let me just, you know, add a kind of point to, you know, the potential of going back to Connecticut. I'm not saying at all that I think Trump, you know, has ruled out going back to Connecticut action. I think he would prefer not to. I think he, for a whole variety of reasons. And so I think, as you said earlier, we could be in a period of no peace, no war for some period of time here. On the other hand, I can hear voices telling him, look, you got to do what Nixon did in 1973 with the Christmas bombing. You know, you have one big, massive spasm of violence will get them to the table. Now, again, that's, you know, they've tried that like three or four times and it's not gotten them to the table. Maybe it will this time. I don't know. I do think there's a potential here, though, that if he were, and I think there will be institutional barriers to this, but if he were to make good on his threats to go after the electricity production and distribution system, the bridges, et cetera. I mean, I think, first of all, I think there's still enough integrity in the system that the lawyers would make sure that the targets were only those that were dual use, you know, to maintain, you know, stay inside the laws of armed conflict. I think that's right. I'm not 100% sure of that, but I think that's right. But if he were to go, you know, the full Monty and really just go after all these civilian targets, I do think that there would be a reaction inside the country, because it will go from being a war on the regime to being a war against the Iranian people. And I think that could really actually redound, you know, and I think there may be some, like Vahidi, whose attitude is bring it on. You know, that's going to help us.
Yeah. Well, that's why I think it could happen. I hadn't thought about the Nixon and the Hanoi Haiphong bombing in, was, I guess, 73?
Yeah, December 73.
I think that's a very good analogy. I wouldn't be at all surprised if somebody's using it. On the law of armed conflict, we can defer to the lawyers, but of course they fired an awful lot of the senior lawyers.
Yeah, that's what worries lawyers, me. That's why I'm not completely, right? I'm not completely confident in my judgment.
And the other thing I would say is, you know, in practice, if it's the kind of lawyer who wants to make the argument that his client wants to hear, you know, when we did Iraq in 1991, we hit the power grid.
Same with Kosovo.
We took it down. These
carbon
fancy munitions
bombs.
Carbon fiber that shorted everything out, which was hell to clean up, which we hadn't really thought about. Because you can say, well, you know, the electrical power grid is supporting the computers in the air defense centers. Bridges, you know, well, they're, you know, they still have mobile launchers, and the mobile launchers go on roads, and the roads have bridges, so you can take out all the bridges. So I think he could get away with that. And as for how the country would react, is the House going to impeach him? No. I mean, a Democratic House will probably impeach him anyway, but they won't get anywhere in the Senate, even if the Democrats take it. Do people care? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. They care about the price of gas.
Right.
But I, you know, there's even a certain point where, you know, if Trump is hearing, as I suspect he is, that they'll probably lose the House anyway.
Right.
Why should he care?
Yeah. Well, I think they're now getting close to the point where I think a lot of them are afraid they're going to lose the Senate as well. And there's good data to make the argument for why they should be afraid of that. I guess we'll find out what happens in the war. We're kind of running low on time, Elliot. I do want to touch on one other issue because it just aggravates me no end. Reports that the administration is negotiating to deport the 1,100 Afghans who are still in Qatar, who came out when the regime collapsed, 5 years ago, to the Democratic Republic of Congo, you know, a kind of active civil war, you know, space where, you know, millions have lost their lives. To me, this is, you know, doing something to people who stood with us and fought with us. It's disgraceful and a stain on the national honor.
It is. I mean, it's utterly despicable. The only thing I could add to that, and it's a blot on our honor, and it's a disgrace. I mean, we have unfortunately really disgraced ourselves in the exit from Afghanistan in a way that we didn't in South Vietnam. You know, in the case of South Vietnam, we really did make every effort to get people out. I mean, it was still a horror show, but we did make an effort to get people out and then to absorb them. You know, for me, the thing that this brings home is the kind of maniacal hostility to immigrants on the part of some people in this administration. I mean, somebody like Stephen Miller, who I think is genuinely evil, it's sick. It's pathological. And it's so contrary to what we are. We're a nation of immigrants. You know, you and I are the grandchildren of immigrants.
So is Stephen Miller.
And you know, where does this come from? I mean, it is pathological. It's the only word I can use for it.
Yeah, no, it's terrible. And this really is a huge blot. And I hope they fail in their effort to do this. But I'm fearful. Yeah,
I hope some of the veterans on the Republican side engage on this. I suspect they might.
I hope so. Well, we'll be back next week to see, you know, what further jackassery we can uncover. We'll find out.
As always, we'll have a rich menu.
I'm afraid so. And we may have some, you know, greater insight into, you know, who can absorb the most pain.